Good afternoon. Thanks to Eric for putting this session together, and thanks for the organizers for accepting it. So I'm going to take you on a little tour of autism genetics and how it intersects with the genetics of other psychiatric disorders today. So, of course, we all know that genetic variation is very important in autism. It's very strong. And that autism is both clinically and genetically heterogeneous. Current genetic epidemiology tells us that there's an over 30-fold increase in risk for siblings, recurrence risk in siblings, and that twin studies, a meta-analysis of twin studies, has given us a heritability estimate greater than 80%. But can genetics tell us anything about the specificity of psychiatric illness, the specificity of the diagnostic categories, the boundaries between them, the risk factors? Put another way, does DNA respect the DSM? Is the DSM even relevant for etiologic studies? So these are the kinds of things that I hope that the data that I present will be able to answer. So we're going to start with rare variation, and then we're going to move to common variation. So with respect to rare variation, we have copy number variants. So some of the first intriguing leads about the biology of autism emerged from studies of copy number variation. So what are copy number variants? Well, this is basic structural variation in the DNA at the chromosomal level. So these are rare genomic imbalances. They can be gains or losses or rearrangements of DNA. Examples are chromosomal microduplications, deletions, inversions, translocations. And they're small, they're submicroscopic. And I say they're rare, but of course they're much more abundant in the genome than even SNPs are, which we used to think were the most abundant structures. They account for about 12% of human genomic DNA. And they range in size from anything from like one kilobase to several megabases. So normally they span multiple genes. It could be several genes. But I'm going to take a quick detour into another way to look at rare variation, which is with next-generation sequencing methods, including whole exome sequencing and whole genome sequencing. And I don't know if you remember, but 2 years ago now, these three papers were published at the same time in Nature. In each of them, used next-generation sequencing methods to look for rare variation in autism. They looked in nearly 600 trios and found more than 413 potentially functional point mutations, which were identified across the three studies in this 600 trios. And the thing is, each study identified different mutations. There were 17 genes that were hit twice with functional variants, purported functional variants, because it's very hard to tell still. But only 9.5 hits were expected just from random mutations, so this was a significant difference. There were no genes that were hit three times. But the genes that were hit twice, really, it was thought that those would point us to which subsets are relevant to autism. So what have we learned from sequencing to date? Whoops, how do I back this up now? Let's see. Where is the page up on this? What? Back it up. Yeah, back. There we go. Okay, thanks. I'm not a PC user anymore, and it's showing. So, so from sequencing, we know so far that there's a real excess of new mutations. Maybe 10 to 20% of cases have a relevant exome-based de novo mutation that didn't exist in the parents' germlines before. They don't appear to be Mendelian causes, but actual risk factors like copy number variants that only confer 10 to 20 times relative risk. There is some evidence of loss of function origin in another maybe 5% of cases, but most of these mutations are not unique to autism. They do cross diagnostic boundaries. And the majority of autism cases do not have any simple genetic risk factor, don't have a de novo CNV, don't have a point mutation or a loss of function hit. So this is what we know so far. Now, the Autism Sequencing Consortium is carrying on this effort in a very big way, and I know that very soon they're going to be publishing a paper that's going to give us even more insights into this. But back now to copy number variants, because I was very excited to see that this paper came out just at the beginning of this month, actually May 1st. This is from the Autism Genome Project, the AGP, and they published this paper, which is the latest, largest, best study of rare structural changes to date. They looked in almost 2,500 autism families, almost 4,800 controls, and what they found was that the overall burden of these structural changes was significantly higher in the families with autism. And they found numerous rare variants. And in fact, there were many genes, but they actually converged on a couple, well, actually three or four, very interconnected cellular pathways. And these pathways are involved in brain development, synapse function, and chromatin regulation. And this is a very nice schematic presenting those results here that I've borrowed from Steve Scherer in the AGP. And I don't have a pointer, but let me see if I can do this. No. So in the circles at the top, is there a pointer here? Oh, okay, great, thanks. So, no. Okay, it's just a clicker. So, anyhow, what you can see is that there are different groups of genes in the top diagram, Venn diagram, that overlap. There were 122 genes with loss of function, de novo, single nucleotide variants. There were 92 known ASD genes. There were 31 genes with loss of function, single nucleotide variants in males, and there were 113 genes that they got from another analysis. They put them all together. There's a lot of overlap. But the main thing is that in the bottom schematic, you can see that these pathways also intersect. So there's a pathway that the genes are involved in neuronal development, and axon guidance. There's another one that the genes are mostly involved in MAPK signaling and other kinds of signaling, including genes like P10 that we know very well. And the bottom one is a pathway involving chromatin modification and transcription regulation. And these all intersect and overlap, which I think is fascinating and actually good for us. So this study actually came out with a recommendation about care for people with autism, which I think needs to be emphasized. Because they revealed dozens of structural changes that were linked to subtypes of autism that were associated with medical issues. Thank you. Warranting immediate medical attention. And these were copy number variants that involved a gene, for instance, that elevated risk for seizures and epilepsy in 9 families. There was another one that indicated a high risk for muscular dystrophy in several other families. And then in other families still, there was a CNV that indicated syndromes associated with heart problems. So, you know, and Steve Scherer was pretty strong about this. You know, the AGP investigators, as a result of these analyses, are actually calling for broad use of copy number variant screening as the next step in individualized diagnosis and treatment of autism. So I think we need to pay attention to that. So from CNVs, we know that about 5% of autism cases have at least one new copy number variant, and about 3% have actually known pathogenic CNVs. So these are copy number variants that are known to be pathogenic. Interesting to me is that the percentage of females is higher in the carriers of these highly penetrant pathogenic copy number variants. So whereas among all affected, the male-to-female ratio was 6-1, among these penetrant pathogenic copy number variants, the male-to-female ratio was 2-1, which I think indicates pretty clearly that there's a different kind of genetic architecture going on with the females. Another point to make about this is that these copy number variants, the confirmed copy number variants, confer risk to a very wide range of phenotypes. It's not just autism. It's schizophrenia, it's epilepsy, it's developmental delay, it's intellectual disability, and on and on. Because copy number variants do span multiple genes, individual genes have been slow to emerge from these types of analyses, but what we know now from the AGP paper is that all these different genes really do converge on a few significant biological pathways, and that's getting us closer. Now I'm going to make a switch, and we're going to move over to common variation, common genetic variation. So I'm going to tell you about some studies that came out of the Psychiatric Genomics Consortium. So the PGC was founded in 2007, and its purpose was to conduct meta-analyses of existing genome-wide association studies for psychiatric disease, to put as many samples together as possible to increase power. It is the largest consortium in the history of psychiatry and the largest biological experiment in the field today. It had three specific aims at the beginning: to conduct disorder-specific meta-analyses, cross-disorder meta-analyses, and comorbidity meta-analyses. So in the beginning, there were five disorders that we were focusing on in the PGC: ADHD, autism, bipolar disorder, major depression, and schizophrenia. So I'm a member of the cross-disorder analysis group as well as the autism working group. We had two questions, and this paper came out February last year, I believe. What findings would we see when we looked at all five disorders in a single GWAS? Because if risk is correlated across disorders, this approach could actually show us loci that we didn't see in an individual analysis because of power. So for the variants that we already know are associated, we also wanted to know, what are their cross-disorder effects? Can we clarify genetic relationships? So this was the initial study. So you can see here that these are the disorders. These are the number of studies participating, number of cases, number of controls. We had over 61,000 people, and we looked at 1.2 million SNPs, many of which, of course, more than half of which were imputed because these were all genotypes on different platforms. And this is the paper that came out in The Lancet last February. So these were our results in a nutshell. We had four genome-wide significant hits. And I'm going to tell you about a couple of these genes in particular. But listen, I mean, we're looking at common variation, very small effect sizes, 61,000 individuals. We found four genome-wide hits, okay? One of the genes that I'm going to highlight is this calcium channel signaling gene, CACNA1C. It's interesting because it causes Timothy syndrome, which you can see all the phenotypic characters that come with Timothy syndrome, including autism. Also, calcium channels mediate the influx of calcium ions into the cell when the membrane is polarized. So this is pretty far upstream. This is very basic biology we're talking about. Another thing I want to point out is that this is a predicted target of this microRNA 137, and I'll tell you more about that in a minute. We also looked at the overlap between autism and schizophrenia because several of us in the group were very interested in this. And we actually found three different hits there that were genome-wide significant. I'm just going to highlight a couple of those. One of them is TCF4, which encodes a protein that acts as a transcription factor. So it's involved in initiation of neuronal differentiation, and it's expressed mostly in the brain and in developing embryonic tissues. It causes Pitt-Hopkins syndrome, but it's known to be associated with schizophrenia, and also it's another predicted target of this microRNA 137. So what about miR-137? What's so special about it? So it's a short, non-coding microRNA. So it doesn't code for a protein. It's regulatory. It was the strongest, the gene that codes for the microRNA, miR-137, was the strongest signal in the PGC schizophrenia GWAS meta-analysis by far. It's thought to regulate these two other genes, TCF4 and this calcium channel signaling gene. And it's known to regulate dendritic development, neuron maturation. Overexpression of it, in fact, inhibits dendritic morphogenesis, phenotypic maturation, and spine development. So it's a pretty interesting little molecule. And it does this. It inhibits these the dendritic morphogenesis and maturation in both brain and cultured primary neurons. So moving on quickly, we've now from this analysis know that there are actually genuine biological clues beginning to emerge from these studies of common variation as well as the rare variation. And we just talked about the interesting genes here. Another point to make, though, like the copy number variants, many common SNP associations just don't respect the traditionally defined clinical boundaries at all, because some of the SNPs were shared by all five psychiatric disorders, and some of them were shared by both autism and schizophrenia. So they're not unique and do not respect the boundaries. Now, the PGC is also doing an autism meta-analysis, which hasn't been published yet because we just finished the analyses. We're working on a paper now. We looked at data from six family-based studies across five different genotyping arrays. These are the participating data collections. These are the genotyping arrays that were used for them. I'm not going to give you a lot of detail on this now because I'm running out of time, and there's a poster tomorrow that's going to give you a lot more information about this. So just suffice it to say that we did find one genome-wide significant hit with the European ancestry cohort, which is over 5,300 individuals, and we found another one with the entire cohort, which was 6,300 individuals. But I urge you to take a look at the poster for more details on this. This is the astatactin 2 locus that I'm going to highlight here. It encodes a protein expressed in brain that probably functions in neuronal migration. It interacts with FMR1, which we know encodes FMRP, which controls remodeling and strength of brain connections during normal development, especially learning and remembering, and has also been implicated in other neurodevelopmental disorders such as ADHD, schizophrenia, migraine, and hippocampal volume, in fact. So, enough said about that. We also found an overlap with schizophrenia, just to back up what we found in the PGC cross-disorder group. So we know that now that common variation is important in autism. This was a big debate for a long time about whether it was a rare variation or common variation. Of course, it's both. There's some overlap with schizophrenia. And we also know that although discovery of the common variants is going to enable better understanding of the biology, it's going to require many, many more samples. For instance, the latest schizophrenia GWAS meta-analysis involved 25,000 cases and controls, and they ended up finding over 60 GWAS hits. So these are the kinds of samples we need to be amassing. I just want to spend a minute, though, to tell you about what I think is the new frontier in autism genetics, which is epigenetics. And I'm calling it the new frontier simply because there haven't been any published papers with regard to autism for this, although I know that there are several groups working on it now. But just in case you don't know, the study of epigenetics is basically the study of heritable changes in gene expression that occur without changes in the DNA sequence. So there's no sequence change, but the gene expression gets changed due to exposure to environmental factors. So the epigenome is particularly susceptible to dysregulation by environmental agents during gestation, neonatal development, puberty, and old age. And we know this from animal models, basically. And so there are these metastable epialleles. They're alleles that are variably expressed in genetically identical people or animals, individuals, because of the epigenetic changes that have occurred in early development. An example of that is this murine. So in the mouse, there's an allele called the viable yellow agouti allele, and exposure in the mother to BPA actually influences how this allele is getting expressed, the more of a yellow color. But why I'm excited about this and talking about it today is because just this last month, there was a paper published. It was the first study ever published to conclusively demonstrate epigenetic changes in humans. And it was a very cool experiment. Actually, they capitalized on a very naturally occurring experiment, and these were the this is the paper, so you can look it up. But in Gambia, there are two different seasons, the rainy season and the dry season, and they have a huge influence on people's diet. people eat very different things in those two periods of time. So this group of investigators very cleverly followed 2,000 women and enrolled them as soon as they became pregnant, and they were, you know, recording their diets the entire time. So they got 167 women who became pregnant, half of them in the dry period and half of them in the rainy season, and their diets were vastly different. And what they found was that maternal nutritional status, not just during early pregnancy but during preconception, actually caused methylation and persistent systemic epigenetic changes, which it's the first time it's really been demonstrated in humans. So clearly, I mean, I know that there are groups working on epigenetics now, and I can't wait to see what they come up with, because this is very important for autism. So just to conclude what we've learned about autism thus far, 5 to 10% of cases carry a large copy number variant. About 5% of cases have two copies of an important gene disabled. Maybe 10% of cases carry a high-risk spontaneous point mutation. But nearly all cases carry a high-risk inherited genetic background defined by both common and rare DNA variants. Autism is highly, highly polygenic, and every single study that I've just reviewed has confirmed this. But it's interesting, polygenicity actually may be characteristic of many, or if not most, complex biomedical diseases. And this is the list: bipolar, schizophrenia, type 1 and type 2 diabetes, Crohn's disease, rheumatoid arthritis, celiac disease, coronary artery disease, the list goes on. They're all highly polygenic. We shouldn't be surprised. It's clear now that common variation plays an important role. Even with small effects, these are important variants. But because the effects are so small individually, we're going to need many, many more samples in order to discover more of them. And this whole debate about the so-called missing heritability that we were all having in genetics a few years ago, it seems quite likely now that it's not missing, it's only hidden until we amass samples that are large enough in order to discover them. And again, I just want to emphasize this point that the AGP paper made with its copy number variants study, because structural variants are so important and play such a large role, and because they so often point to other serious comorbid medical conditions, copy number variant screening should become the standard of care for all autism patients now. Final conclusion, pathways are where it's at. There's been a clear convergence of rare exonic variants, structural variants, microRNAs, even common variants on a very few biological pathways, brain development, synapse function, chromatin regulation. This is not a bad thing. In fact, this point was made in a paper that came out in 2012 by Pat Sullivan, Mark Daly, and Mick O'Donovan. Risk could actually be conferred by the emergent properties of the pathway itself rather than any single component of the pathway. And that's not a bad thing at all, because it may actually be easier to manipulate a dysfunctional pathway into the normal range than to try to replace or fix any of its mutated component parts. And with that, I'll conclude and acknowledge my collaborators, of which there are many who aren't even listed here, but thank you very much.